Welcome to this week's Audio Digest edition of The Herald, from Friday the 1st to Thursday the 7th of June 2018. Read by volunteers at Kuhn Review Print Speaking to the Blind at our studios at the Bishopriggs Media Centre. Coming up in part 1.
Drug gangs preying on the weak to use homes for crimes.
GMB Union uncovers figures showing social care charges are leaving at least 15,000 Scots in debt. An article by Stephen Maysmith.
Harvey Weinstein pleads not guilty to sex charges as his lawyer, quote, begins fight.
From the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 7th of June. Politics. SNP's Ian Blackford signals more flights to Scotland could help party vote for Heathrow expansion. This article by Michael Settle.
Nicola Sturgeon branded delusional amid growth report splits.
Skraeling set to confirm third runway at Heathrow. An article by Michael Settle, UK political editor.
McLeish, trial period is over.
SFA director Gary Hughes to step down following article row over Rangers fans.
Scotland 1, England 3. Gemmell's Scots fall at final hurdle once more in Toulon.
Richie Ramsay, Russell Knox, Ryan Lumsden and Callum Hill qualify for US Open.
This article from the Herald on Monday the 4th of June 2018. News. Drug gangs preying on the weak to use homes for crimes. This article by David Leask. Gangsters are preying on the financial fears of pensioners to take over their homes for drug dealing and racketeering, a major new report has discovered. Organised criminals exploited concerns over the so-called bedroom tax to effectively seize the spare rooms, sheds and garages of elderly tenants, sources told a major academic study. Gangland figures have always needed bases in Scotland's social housing schemes and have a long history of abusing vulnerable residents and attempting to corrupt concierges and housing workers to gain access to homes. Now researchers, in a rare investigation of how Scotland's communities are affected by organised crime, have uncovered new and devious tricks to control property. A housing officer, cited anonymously in research, said organised crime groups were identifying maybe elderly customers whose families had grown up and moved away, who knew that the whole bedroom tax agenda was on. They were basically saying to people, you either move out to a smaller house or you pay the additional charge. They were saying, I will give you the money and you will pay that into your rent account and we'll use your room or we will use your shed, your garage, your lockup, and you'll ask no questions. In fact, the Scottish Government had put in place measures to mitigate cuts to housing benefits introduced by the Conservatives. However, the research suggests just how flexible criminals were in acting on the latest news. The new report, called Community Experiences of Serious Organised Crime in Scotland, was carried out by experts at Glasgow, Stirling and other universities for the Scottish Government and under the auspices of the Scottish Centre for Crime and Justice Research. It is believed to be the first qualitative look at how gangsterism hits communities and took a year and a half to complete. The bedroom tax scam helped underline one of its key findings, that fighting crime cannot be left to police alone. Housing officers, for example, are often on the front line with more regular contact with criminals and their victims than law enforcement. Some big social landlords, such as Glasgow Housing Association, are already plugged into the fight with drug dealing, gun running and human trafficking, with both specialist and non-specialist housing officers trained to look for the telltale footprints of organised crime. One housing officer told the researchers his or her colleagues had to understand they may be that golden thread in somebody's life. He added, police might dip in and out of your life, or they might not. Education, social work, social care may or may not, but whilst you're living in social housing, you will have that common relationship, and it is just about being aware and signposting. Another housing officer stressed criminals were always on the lookout for vulnerable tenants. He or she said, if they live in the area, they know who they can target. They know exactly what they're doing. They'll also then know in terms of some of our customer groups who have got severe issues with alcohol or drug addictions and on mental health issues, and they play on that. The research, to be unveiled at a meeting of Scotland's Serious and Organised Crime Task Force today, underlined that housing was far from always joined up with policing. It concluded, housing services in particular were found to be a key source of local intelligence, and schools a key point of intervention, but with little internal coordination. This disconnect was exacerbated in some cases by the removal of key service offices, including police stations and social work offices, from the local area, resulting in a weakening of community-level knowledge. The researchers want to put community development at the heart of the fight with organised crime, a scourge that is both the cause of and the symptom of poverty. They also stress the importance of schools, themselves dealing with gangland issues like the sale of drugs over social media, in identifying young people vulnerable to the next victims or foot soldiers of criminals. And police, they said, need to understand some tactics, such as repeated stop and search, could backfire. Scotland's response to organised crime has already won international attention. Paul Carberry of Action for Children, a member of the Organised Crime Task Force, stressed the country already understood it could not arrest itself out of the problem. However, researcher Alistair Fraser of Glasgow University said the country still had much to do to change its conversation about the issue. A new conversation was needed on whether gangsterism was glamorised. He said, organised crime doesn't exist as a secretive subculture hidden from view, but is stitched into the fabric of our communities. The academics even found one witness who cited a roadside shrine to a fallen criminal made up of 1,000 empty bottles of Buckfast. This article by David Leask.
GMB Union uncovers figures showing social care charges are leaving at least 15,000 Scots in debt. An article by Stephen Maysmith, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 5th of June 2018. Thousands of Scots who need social care are struggling with debt as a result of soaring care charges, according to new figures. At least 15,000 people behind on social care payments, and at least 6,000 of those accounts are in the hands of debt managers, according to data released by Scottish councils under Freedom of Information. The GMB union, which represents care workers, carried out the investigation and claimed the issue was a ticking time bomb at the heart of the finances of individuals and families with care needs. Four Scottish councils, Glasgow, Inverclyde, Scottish Borders and East Lothian, said they had taken someone to court over unpaid care fees last year. The total of cases pursued to court, just 11, is much lower than in England, but the union said it was a worrying sign as no such cases had been taken in 2015-16. Charges for non-residential care have been introduced in many councils in recent years for services such as attending a day centre, telecare monitoring, sheltered housing and shopping services. In the context of austerity budgets, local authorities, which already charged for some or all of those services, have chosen to increase the charges or reduce the amount of an individual's income, which they are allowed to keep before they begin being charged for care. Policies appear to vary widely. Inverclyde Council took legal action against one person last year despite having just 154 accounts in arrears, while Glasgow City Council, which has 2,483 overdue accounts, only pursued three to court. Meanwhile, charges continue to increase in many areas. Last Friday, Inverclyde introduced a new charge of £2.50 a week for elderly people who need a community alarm service, although it pointed out many other councils already charge for this service and many charge more. Overall, the GMB said at least 166,000 people across the UK are trapped in debt for their social care. In Scotland, 64,080 invoices were issued by councils last year, of which 15,733 were in arrears. Not all of these will be individuals, but as 8 councils in Scotland, one quarter, did not respond to the FOI request, the union said 15,000 people were likely to be facing arrears, even at a conservative estimate. Sharon Wild, GMB National Officer, said these stark figures show the UK's social care ticking time bomb has now blown a gaping hole in families' finances. The fact more than 1,000 people have been taken to court because they're unable to pay for their own care or that of their loved ones shows the system just isn't working. Meanwhile, our ageing population is creating a huge demand for care staff, but caring is still not seen as a sought-after career. The lack of local authority funding often means low pay, and the sector is struggling to recruit and retain the dedicated staff needed to provide the best care to the UK's most vulnerable people. We need a clear, coherent strategy for funding social care now and in the future. Otherwise, the struggle to recruit and retain carers will become even more acute, while tens of thousands of people are plunged into debt trying to pay for the level of support that they need. A spokesman for Inverclyde Council said, "We take the recovery of debt very seriously, but will always endeavour to strike the right balance between personal circumstances, welfare, and the pressure on public services. The simple fact is we have only proceeded with court action on one occasion over this period and will resolve the vast majority of cases without the need to take legal steps." Jeff Adamson, chair of the campaign Scotland Against the Care Tax, said, "We have known for a long time that social care charges drive disabled people into poverty, but these figures are truly shocking. Not only are people who come to councils seeking help at a time of crisis being driven into debt, councils then take them to court. This needs to stop." Councillor Peter Johnston, COSLA's health and wellbeing spokesperson, said they're under strain from an increase in demand and broad funding pressures on local government. COSLA upholds the principle of charging for some social care services on the basis that those who can afford to pay a contribution towards the cost of the care they receive do so. "We also believe that co-payment empowers a person's ability to make choices with regard to the care they receive, and any income raised through charging is invested back into social care. These figures clearly show that councils are supporting those who are in arrears to manage any debts. Meanwhile, local authorities are striving to reform adult social care to provide better quality, more efficient services in challenging times. We also recognise the workforce challenges and are working closely with partners to make social care a more attractive career."
The Herald Scotland, on Wednesday, the 6th of June 2018. News section. Harvey Weinstein pleads not guilty to sex charges as his lawyer, quote, "begins fight." This article from the Herald Scotland online. Harvey Weinstein's lawyer has said he is ready to, quote, "begin our fight," as the film producer pleaded not guilty to Rape and Criminal Sex Act charges. Weinstein appeared at a Manhattan court for a hearing on Tuesday in his first public appearance since he was first charged less than 2 weeks ago. He wore a black suit and tie and was accompanied by his lawyer, Benjamin Braffman, as he arrived at the court to a crowd of reporters and photographers. Inside the court, the 66-year-old entered his plea of not guilty against the charges, which related to two separate women. Speaking outside the court shortly after, Mr. Braffman said, "Today is the first day of this process. We begin our fight now. We will fight this case in the courtroom. I'm pleased with what happened today. We were given enough time to do our job and do it, hopefully, well." Mr. Braffman said they are going to file a series of legal motions that will get us more information and may impact the process. He added that, if they are successful, there may not be a trial,
and that if there is, they will proceed vigorously to try and clear Mr. Weinstein's name. He said he believes the two charges are eminently defensible, and that Weinstein will appear in court again on September the 20th. Mr. Braffman previously said that Weinstein intended to enter a plea of not guilty against the charges when he was first charged on May the 25th in New York. Weinstein's not guilty plea comes after he was indicted by a grand jury on the charges, rape in the first and third degrees, and a criminal sexual act in the first degree last Wednesday. He was due to face the grand jury, the panel convened by the Manhattan District Attorney at the time, but he did not attend on the advice of his lawyers. They said the former movie mogul did not have enough time to prepare to testify, and that he only learned on the day he was charged of the identities of the two women relating to the charges. The day he was charged was Weinstein's first public appearance since facing numerous allegations of sexual misconduct. He is out on a $1 million, £751,060 bail, and must wear an electronic tracking device at all times. He has also surrendered his passport and has agreed to stay within the states of New York and Connecticut. Weinstein denies all allegations of non-consensual sex. This article was from the Herald Scotland online. Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com.
From the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 7th of June. Politics. SNP's Ian Blackford signals more flights to Scotland could help party vote for Heathrow expansion. This article by Michael Settle. The SNP leadership has signalled that getting more flights from London to Scotland could help persuade it to back the UK's government controversial plan for a third runway at Heathrow Airport. The sign might prove significant in getting the Conservative plan through Westminster, as Labour has indicated that it is likely to oppose the £14 billion airport expansion because it had yet to pass four key tests it had set on the need to carbon dioxide emissions and noise and minimise the local environmental impact, as well as helping connectivity to regional airports. London MP John McDonald, the Shadow Chancellor, has come out against the plan, stressing previously how he could not see how Labour's tests could be met. With a number of Conservative rebels saying they would also oppose the expansion plan, which could cancel out any help the government would get from the 10 Democratic Unionists, then the SNP's 35 MPs could prove crucial in the forthcoming Commons vote. The government says the building of a new two-mile runway will create an additional 260,000 flights a year, enabling the airport to increase its annual capacity from 86 million passengers to 130 million. Chris Grayling, the Transport Secretary, said it would boost the economy by up to £74 billion in London and beyond. Business leaders have welcomed the move, saying it will give a confidence boost to international investors, but green campaigners warned it would make London's air more dangerous to breathe. The Scottish Government has a Memorandum of Understanding with Heathrow and Keith Brown, the Scottish Government's Economic Secretary, responding to the UK Government's announcement on Tuesday, said the Heathrow plan offered significant job creation and major investment opportunities, and pointed out that the basing of a logistics hub in Scotland was an important part of the expansion offer. Growing the number of direct international air routes to and from Scotland remains a priority for this government, but the proposals from Heathrow could eventually offer all our airports a range of benefits that will help them grow passenger numbers and continue to build on their successes, he added. His nationalist colleague Ian Blackford, the SNP leader at Westminster, stressed how the party would look very carefully at the detailed proposals for the third runway. He explained, "We want to make sure Scotland's economic interests are protected as much as possible. That's multifaceted. That's about slots into Heathrow. It's about what's in it for Scottish airports and airlines operating out of Scotland. It's about what happens in the supply chain. There are wider issues of environment, noise, pollution, and all the rest of it. We will look very carefully at all those things. The Highland MP stressed how there was a need to improve connectivity into Scotland, which meant flights into Heathrow from Scotland and the potential to grow Scottish airports on a direct point-to-point basis. Asked if creating more flights between Scotland and Heathrow would help persuade the SNP to support the UK's government plan, Mr Blackford said, yes, of course, that's part of the picture we will have to consider. Asked if nationalist support in the Commons would therefore be conditional, he replied, I've not said that. What I have said is that we will look at this on the basis of what is in the economic interests of Scotland, Scottish aviation and Scottish airports. You may want to characterise that as I'm trying to get as a good deal for Scotland as possible. OK, so be it. That's my job.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for queue and review. Now, back to the main programme.
This article from the Herald on Monday, the 4th of June 2018. Politics. Nicola Sturgeon branded delusional amid growth report splits. This article by Tom Gordon. Nicola Sturgeon has been branded borderline delusional after describing the reaction to the SNP's Growth Commission as heartening. Despite a week of intense criticism from the left of the Yes movement, the First Minister said publication of the 354-page report had shifted political debate in a very positive direction. Her comments coincided with Dennis Canavan, who chaired the Yes Scotland campaign in 2014, criticising the report as over-reliant on the Scottish establishment. The Scottish Socialist Party, which was part of Yes Scotland, also issued an open letter urging the wider Yes movement to reject the divisive Conservative document. The Commission, chaired by corporate lobbyist Andrew Wilson, forecast years of tight public spending to halve the deficit after a Yes vote and recommended keeping the pound. It has been attacked by former Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill, former SNP MP George Kerevan, the Commonweal think tank and Yes-leaning commentators Ian McWhirter, Mike Small, Alex Bell and Darren McGarvey. A common complaint is the report's austerity-light prescription for the early years and binding an independent Scotland to a UK monetary policy over which it had no control. Mr Bell, a former adviser to Alex Salmond, called the report a suicide note. Mr McWhirter said it was the last redoubt of crude austerity economics. And Mr McCaskill suggested the SNP was becoming the new SNP, much as Labour became New Labour under Tony Blair. However, writing in the Sunday Herald, Ms Sturgeon said, "The initial response to the Commission's report has been heartening. Those within the independence movement who have expressed the desire for a different approach have done so in a constructive manner. I welcome that and look forward to them being a full part of the debate over the summer." She also said previous opponents of independence now saw it as more credible, as the report was a frank recognition of the challenges we face and how we overcome them. She said, "After spending 2 years discussing how we mitigate the economic damage caused by Brexit, it is very refreshing to now be discussing the immense opportunities offered by having the full range of powers to take economic decisions tailored to Scotland's needs. It is a debate based on hope, not despair. She said claims the report advocated austerity were bogus and unionist scare stories. The document offered clear and solid foundations to convert no voters to yes, she said. Mr. Canavan said the Commission's decision to consult business leaders, such as the CBI and Institute of Directors, but not any trade unions, had been a grave omission. STUC General Secretary Graham Smith said, many share Dennis Canavan's concerns, but the STUC is focused on the content of the report and playing an active part in the national conversation about the progressive policies needed to address Scotland's deep-seated and long-standing economic challenges, whether independent or not. Ms. Sturgeon also tweeted a link to a Financial Times article by economist Professor John Kay, a member of her Standing Council on Europe, calling it another example of the Growth Commission report re-energising the debate about the possibilities of independence. Professor Kay's article said an independent Scotland would inherit a share of the UK's unpromising fiscal position and lose the benefit of the subsidy from England of the Barnett formula. He said the report had a strong pro-business focus, adding, any nationalists who believe that independence would mean freedom from budgetary constraints are indulging a fantasy. Tory MSP Murdo Fraser said Nicola Sturgeon clearly wants to gloss over splits among independence supporters ahead of the SNP conference later this week. But to describe the reaction to the Growth Commission report as heartening is bordering on the delusional. The SNP have alienated many hardcore separatists, but the bigger problem for Ms Sturgeon is that the people of Scotland have no interest whatsoever in another referendum. Scottish Lib Dem leader Willie Rennie added, it takes a deluded conference to suggest a report that divided nationalists will manage to unite no voters. The First Minister's relentless defence of this paper on Twitter and in the papers reveals the panic in the SNP leadership. They're desperately trying to present a positive front to the economic case for independence, which has ultimately disappointed the membership just in time for their conference. The loose currency plans and austerity warnings in the Growth Commission and recent poor growth projections will not convince people isolation is a good idea. Labour MSP Jackie Bailey said, yet again Nicola Sturgeon has been forced to defend her cuts commission. The First Minister says she has been heartened by the response. That response has been senior nationalists like Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill and Policy Chief Alex Bell skewering the report for promising a decade of austerity. Only Labour now offers the anti-austerity economic programme that the people of Scotland want. An SNP spokesperson said, the Tories are rattled and Murdo Fraser is reduced to hurling insulting potshots. Yet it is clear that the Growth Commission has opened a lively, wide-ranging discussion from all sides of the debate. We know that some within the independence movement have expressed the desire for a different approach. Their views are welcome and we look forward to key figures and bodies like trade unions and businesses playing a full part in the debate over the summer about the kind of country Scotland can be. This article by Tom Gordon.
Chris Grayling set to confirm third runway at Heathrow. An article by Michael Settle, UK political editor, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 5th of June 2018. Chris Grayling, the Under Fire Transport Secretary, is set to confirm the UK government's plan to press ahead with the third runway at Heathrow Airport. After considering the issue at the Cabinet's Economic Subcommittee, it is being discussed this morning by full Cabinet, which is expected to give its approval. An airport's national policy statement will then be published. Mr Grayling, who yesterday came under fierce attack over the rail disruption in northern England, is due to face MPs again this afternoon to give a Commons statement on the government's Heathrow expansion plans. MPs are likely to vote on the issue within 3 weeks. John Glenn, the Treasury Minister, gave his backing to the plan for a third runway at Heathrow, saying, "This has gone on for a very long time. From the perspective of UK PLC, we need to expand our capacity and this is the right thing to do. He signalled that there would be an understanding with MPs whose constituencies would be impacted by a third runway, such as Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson, who represents Uxbridge in North London. Mr Glenn told BBC Radio's Today programme, I imagine that there are understandings around constituency MPs who have specific interests. Obviously, constituency commitments would normally come first. He said the issue of offering MPs a free vote was a matter for the Chief Whip. But Justine Greening, the former Conservative Transport Secretary, insisted there should be a free vote and made clear that if the vote was whipped, she would defy the government by voting against the third runway proposal. I have always been clear that I can't support this proposal going through Parliament, even if it's whipped. And indeed, the Prime Minister is very clear this is not a party political issue. These are local MPs who need to represent our local communities. I do think that Parliament needs to be allowed to express its will, and I don't think there should be a whipped vote, said the Putney MP. Asked about the Foreign Secretary's previous opposition to expansion, Ms Greening said, for ministers involved in this, there has always been a special dispensation for them to be able to represent their local communities. That's always been very clear-cut. Boris has got a long-standing position on this, as I have, and I hope that he is allowed to represent his community and his views when the vote comes into Parliament. In the past, there have been assurances that this would be a free vote. I hope they're stuck to, added Ms Greening. John Stewart, chairman of anti-Heathrow expansion group HACAN, said, this is a bad day for residents. Many communities will face a tsunami of noise if a third runway goes ahead. Many people who will be under new flight paths will find their lives changed forever. We will continue to oppose a new runway, but obviously, if it becomes inevitable, we will fight for the best conditions possible for residents, he added. Proponents of building a third runway at the major hub say it is the best option to increase capacity and boost the national economy while being cost-effective. However, critics warn the plan is expensive and complex and bad for the environment. While one group hinted legal action may be taken against the Department for Transport over its, quote, dodgy handling of the process. Alternative schemes include expanding Gatwick Airport in West Sussex. Any announcement in favour of a third runway is likely to be met with dismay by MPs from across the divide whose constituencies are already affected by Heathrow air traffic. On Monday, Liberal Democrat leader Sir Vince Cable, whose Twickenham seat stands to be affected by expansion, branded the scheme ill-conceived. Meanwhile, Extend the Runway, a group advocating increasing capacity by lengthening the airport's northern runway, said the Transport Department, quotes, lacks both expertise and attention to detail, end of quotation, and had not listened to its proposal. People should have zero confidence that the DfT have run a rigorous process on Heathrow's expensive and complex plan, the group said on Twitter. The No Third Runway Coalition, which counts Sir Vince and Labour's John McDonnell, the Shadow Chancellor, among its members, said the department's process had been dodgy and has favoured Heathrow Airport Limited from the start. That will be proven in court if it comes to it, they added. The Aviation Environmental Federation said it was, quotes, extremely unlikely that the government will have been able to find solutions to key challenges related to the environmental impacts of expansion. The group said the aviation strategy, which is being taken forward under a separate process to the Heathrow's NPS, will set out now how the environmental impacts of aviation nationally should be tackled, but will not be consulted upon until later this year, with the publication of the final strategy not expected until the middle of next year. The decision on Heathrow is set to be taken, therefore, in the absence of any policy on how to tackle aviation's carbon emissions. So, with no clarity on whether limits on aviation growth will be needed in order to meet climate change obligations.
The Herald, Monday, June the 4th. Sport, football. McLeish, trial period is over. Alex McLeish last night admitted the trial period is over following Scotland's end-of-season tour of Peru and Mexico and vowed to focus on securing qualification for the Euro 2020 finals in future. McLeish's men were subjected to a mauling in their friendly with Russia 2018 finalist Mexico in the Azteca Stadium on Saturday evening, but limited the damage to a 1-0 defeat. McLeish handed no fewer than 9 new players their first caps in South and Central America over the past fortnight, but stressed that he will look to field the strongest sides available to him going forward. "I had to do some different things," he said. "We have not qualified for 20 years, so I had to try something different. Gordon Strachan was unlucky, and we have looked at games over the last 4 or 5 years where our Achilles heel has always been one mistake." Several Scotland regulars were excused from travelling to Peru and Mexico at the request of their clubs, and there were 6 call-offs from the original 24-man squad. But McLeish believes players have emerged on the tour who will feature going forward. "Johnny Russell came into the game and had a smashing game on Saturday night," he said, "and big Stephen O'Donnell too. He's had a meteoric rise. Lewis Stevenson did well, and on Saturday night Graham Shinney was a bit of a warrior, as he has shown throughout his Aberdeen career." McLeish stressed he hadn't ruled out older players such as Darren Fletcher, James McArthur and James Morrison, who haven't featured under him since he took charge of Scotland for a second time out of contention for a call-up. "I wouldn't say that they have no chance of playing," he said. "I have been in dialogue with McArthur over the last 4 months or so. McArthur is an integral part of the Scottish national team. He's a great player." McLeish also admitted that Oliver Burke, who has sparkled in the Toulon tournament, is in his thoughts. "I think Ollie kind of lost his way a wee bit, but that performance in Toulon is going to enhance the big fella's confidence," said McLeish.
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts. For free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
SFA Director Gary Hughes to step down following article row over Rangers fans. An article by Gordon Stevenson, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 5th of June 2018. Scottish Football Association Director Gary Hughes is to step down on Wednesday following a row over an article in which he referred to Rangers fans as the Great Unwashed. Rangers chairman Dave King had already called for Hughes to be suspended by the SFA after a photograph of a 2006 article from The Publican appeared in a newspaper. Hughes, who was then chief executive of the trade magazine's publisher, was credited as writing in a piece on Glasgow's pubs, "The next best thing to being at Celtic Park, only the Great Unwashed venture south to Ibrox, is watching the game, pint of Tennent's in hand, with some like-minded souls." Now the SFA has announced in a statement that independent non-executive director Hughes will not seek re-election at Wednesday's annual general meeting. Hughes has been on holiday since the row broke out, but has now decided to stand down after returning to Scotland. SFA Chief Executive Ian Maxwell said, "I would like to thank Gary for his service to Scottish football over the past 3 years. He brought a wealth of business experience to the game and a passion to drive Scottish football forward at all levels. We wish him the best of luck for the future and thank him for his efforts as a trusted and valued member of the board." Hughes added, "It has been an honour and a privilege to bring my professional expertise to the game I love. I have been involved in business for 30 years, but the commitment of my board colleagues and indeed everyone involved in Scottish football to improve the national sport in this country has made it an absolute pleasure. I will remain a passionate supporter of the Scottish FA's activities, but it is time to focus on other business interests at home and abroad."
The Herald Scotland. On Thursday, the 7th of June, 2018. Sports section. Scotland 1, England 3. Gemmell's Scots fall at final hurdle once more in Toulon. This article by Mark Walker. A brilliant solo goal from Celtic winger Mikey Johnston wasn't enough to send Scotland to their first ever Toulon tournament final after England's second half comebacks crushed Scott Gemmell's side. The Scots were leading at the break in Obin and looked set to avenge last year's semi-final defeat to the Three Lions. But they were pinned back after the break, and a brace by Arsenal ace Eddie Nketiah and a goal from Everton striker Callum Connolly ended the young Scots' dreams. Scotland will now have to prepare for a third and fourth place playoff against Turkey on Saturday instead. Gemmell admitted he was disappointed at their sluggish display after the break, although insists there are plenty of positives Scotland can take from the tournament. He said, "The players knew the second half wasn't good enough. The first half was, but the second half wasn't. It's as simple as that. Young players can be inconsistent at this level because they're still learning to play, especially against a very good side like England. You have to credit England for their reaction after the break. But for us, we didn't do enough. We knew we would have to contain them for the whole game. We were excellent in the first half. It's very difficult to do that, and I felt we were very, very close to executing our game plan. It's fine margins, and when you play against a very top team, you get punished. We had several chances in the first half, and we played so well, but we're only 1-0 up. In the second half, we have to accept we have come up short. To concede 3 goals in the second half is extremely disappointing. Last year, we came up very short. This year, there's a lot to be positive about because of the first half performance. We really pushed England. There's a lot to be proud about. To top a group featuring France and teams from Africa and Asia, it's a fantastic achievement to top the group. And it's not over yet because we'll be going all out to beat Turkey. Scotland were the better side in the first half, and they came close to the opener when a clipped pass from Billy Gilmore over the top saw captain Oliver Burke collect and turn on the jets down the right flank and motor past Chelsea defender Jake Clark-Salter before bursting through and cracking an angled shot against the post. And it was the Scots who drew first blood with yet another stunning goal, which has been a feature of the Toulon tournament. There seemed little danger when Johnston collected Ian Wilson's pass on the left wing. But the Parkhead talent deftly slalomed his way in and out of two English defenders, which propelled him into the box, where he still had Everton's John Joe Kenny in front of him. He beat him for pace before whipping in a brilliant shot, which proved too much for former Aberdeen and Kilmarnock lone keeper Freddie Woodman as it fizzed past him into the net. It was a brilliant strike, and was up there with Burke's sensational 70-yard run for his goal against South Korea on Saturday. But England were just too strong for the Scots after the break, though they didn't help themselves by sitting far too deep, and Connolly levelled before Nketiah put England into the lead with a goal that matched Johnston's for quality. The Gunners striker killed the contest late on with an excellent strike. Everton striker Fraser Hornby twice went close in the dying moments of the game for Scotland, but Gemmell's side has run their race, and England fully deserved their win. Scotland, 4-2-3-1. McCrory, Ralston, Kerr, Porteous, Taylor, Wilson for Burt, 41, Gilmore, Burke for Middleton, 77, Campbell for Watt, 77, Johnston, Hornby. Subs not used: Doohan, Harvey, Wright, St Clair, Whiten, Hamilton. England, 3-5-2. Woodman, Kenny, Fry, for Tomori, 74, Clark-Salter, De Silva, Connolly, Cook, Vieira for Chaudhry, 69, Dowell, Armstrong for Abraham, 79, Nketiah. Subs not used: Ramsdale, Peters Walker, Davis, Konza, Pierce and Mecha. The referee was M. Nava from Mexico. This article was by Mark Walker.
Richie Ramsay, Russell Knox, Ryan Lumsden and Callum Hill qualify for US Open. An article by Nick Roger, golf correspondent, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday the 5th of June 2018. Next week's US Open on Shinnecock Hills was looking like a Scottish free zone. Thank goodness then for the last chance saloon of the 36-hole sectional qualifiers. Richie Ramsay, who played in the 2007 event as an amateur and came through the qualifying shootout for the 2017 championship, teed up a third appearance in the US showpiece by sharing second place at Walton Heath in Surrey. Across the Atlantic in Ohio, meanwhile, Inverness exile Russell Knox, the two-time PGA Tour winner, eased through in a share of fifth at the Brookside Country Club. Ryan Lumsden, the amateur Anglo-Scot who was beaten in the final of last year's Scottish Amateur Championship, also qualified there on the 6-under limit. Callum Hill of Kinross, who has won a couple of events on the US mini tour scene since turning pro last year, shared top spot at Canoe Brook to set up a debut in the US Open and bolster Scottish numbers in the second men's major of the season.
That's the end of part one. After the break, we'll be coming back with more great articles from the Herald Scotland. This is a message from the NFB UK, the National Federation of the Blind of the United Kingdom. What is NFB UK? The National Federation of the Blind of the United Kingdom, NFB UK, is a self-help organisation of blind, partially sighted and deafblind people helping each other to help ourselves. It's an independent, non-political charity that campaigns for greater rights, citizenship and independent living. How does NFB UK work? We have a network of branches around the country where members and supporters can meet locally. The branches keep our members in touch with their local community and represent their views to local and national authorities and society in general. We provide information for our members in Braille, large print, audio and electronic formats. We work with local and national organisations to improve the quality of life for all blind, partially sighted, deafblind people and those whose sight impairment is part of multidisability. NFB UK campaigns to defend essential benefits and social care services and seeks wider provision of these services and equipment to help us lead independent lives. We have local branches around the country and are aiming to open new branches in more areas. What are the benefits of joining NFB UK? You meet other blind, partially sighted and deafblind people with an interest in peer support, campaigning and making a difference. Members decide and shape which issues and campaigns to focus on, and you decide how you want to work on campaigns. It's free to join this year. You will benefit from our special offer of 1 year's free membership. You can receive regular updates and share information through newsletter, e-group and our audio magazine for members. Founded in 1947, we have played a leading role in Articles for the Blind postal concessions, the retention of different banknote sizes according to denomination, and tactile street paving. Current issues. We are currently active in issues around shared spaces and the built environment, disabled students' allowance, social care and rehabilitation, and the NHS and accessible information standards. Join us! If you are blind, partially sighted, or deafblind, become a full member. We welcome sighted people to join as associate members. Any donation you can make will assist us to further our campaigning. For more information, visit www.nfbuk.org. Contact us via post, NFB UK, Sir John Wilson House, 215 Kirkgate, Wakefield, West Yorkshire, WF1 1JG. That's Whiskey Foxtrot 1 1 Juliet Golf. Telephone us 01924 291 313 or email admin@nfbuk.org. Also on Twitter and Facebook at NFBUK. Now back to the main programme. This is part two. Coming up.
Arts news. Architecture Fringe begins. Porte celebrates Belfield's return. Storm Song at St. Abbs.
Frankie Boyle hunts football hooligans in Russia ahead of World Cup.
Article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday, the 7th of June. Arts. Andrew Lloyd Webber to be honoured at Classic Brit Awards. This article is unattributed. Composer Andrew...
Theatre Review, Love from a Stranger, King's Edinburgh, 3 stars.
Celtic shareholder Trainer sells media firm in £32 million deal. An article by Scott Wright, Deputy Business Editor.
Pinsent's partner heads down under to help grow practice.
Robert McNeil, the world may be in meltdown, but I'm staying cool. An article by Robert McNeil, columnist.
Kenny McCaskill, the deification of Davidson belongs in a parallel universe.
Herald View, new ideas provide bright future for NTS.
Rosemary Goring, why I am raging against the storm of snowflakes.
This article from the Herald on Monday the 4th of June 2018. Arts. Arts news. Architecture Fringe begins. Porte celebrates Belfield's return. Storm Song at St. Abbs. This article by Phil Miller. The Architecture Fringe Festival opens this week with more than 70 events taking place across Scotland from the 8th of June. Now in its third year, the festival was established by architects, designers, engineers, visual artists and curators to encourage broader public debate about architecture and design in Scotland. This year's programme includes architecture, art, dance, music, live performance, film, photography, tours, talks, debates and the summer school. It includes Salon du Refuses, which celebrates rejection and failure in Scottish architecture with an exhibition of works which were never built and competitions that were never won. Themes include Left Behind by Design, stories and experiences from those often omitted or overlooked from traditional urban planning. www.architecturefringe.com. The community of Portobello in Edinburgh is to celebrate the return of the Belfield building to use on June the 23rd. Previously, Portobello Old Parish Church, Belfield, escaped being sold for flats, but it has instead been saved as a community facility by a Save Belfield campaign led by Action Porte. Recent months have seen safety renovations undertaken to prepare the building for public use by local groups such as Portobello Youth Theatre, the Scouts and Woodcraft Folk. The launch event will incorporate an evening cabaret as well as Portobello Community Choir and the Russian Choir of Edinburgh. The local actor and Action Porte board member Shauna MacDonald is staging the event called Belfield's Back. https://www.belfield.scot. The first performance of Storm Song 1881 will be held at St. Abbs on June the 18th, a new show as part of the Echoes touring project. Developed by Minerva Scientifica, it is part of a celebration of women in music and science. It will be held at the EBA Centre. It has been written and will be performed by Eyemouth High School music students with Eyemouth Primary School, Electric Voice Theatre, the meteorologist Marjorie Roy and marine ecologist Karen Diel. St. Abbs Visitor Centre will host a permanent exhibition of Storm Song 1881 on touchscreens, which will be encountered by around 13,000 tourists and locals each year. www.electricvoicetheatre.co.uk. This article by Phil Miller.
The Herald Scotland. On Friday, the 1st of June 2018, Arts and Entertainment section. Frankie Boyle hunts football hooligans in Russia ahead of World Cup. This article from the Herald Scotland online. Frankie Boyle travelled to Russia to explore the myths and stereotypes surrounding the country before it hosts this summer's World Cup. Frankie Goes to Russia sees the Scottish comedian visit several host cities and investigate attitudes towards women, feminism and sexuality. While he was there, the spy poisoning scandal broke, leaving the comedian in Russia at a time when relations between the country and the West were perhaps at their lowest since the Cold War. The comic admitted to feeling twitchy following the attack on Sergei Skripal and his daughter Yulia in Salisbury, which the British government blamed on Russia. In Moscow, Boyle joined a specially selected group of young people at a World Cup volunteer training course, where students are being taught how to greet tourists, as well as how to survive a chemical attack. Boyle saw the World Cup final stadium up close and also met Vladimir Putin's biggest fan, a comic book artist who has a life-size cutout of the president and believes the West propagates anti-Russian propaganda. Boyle went on to visit Rostov-on-Don, a city near the Ukrainian border with a reputation for football violence, and tried to track down the city's hooligans. In Moscow for Election Day, Boyle watched as Mr. Putin was elected president for a fourth time. Reacting to the election victory, Boyle said, "If all goes well, the 2018 World Cup will be one of the greatest triumphs of Vladimir Putin's first 200 years in office. The only risk is that Putin's ego becomes so gigantically enlarged that he actually pops." Putin's determined for the tournament to go smoothly so he can rebuild a positive image of Russia and himself. "If I ever get to meet Vladimir Putin, I will probably take my top off and challenge him to an erotically charged wrestling match, which I will let him win." Frankie Goes to Russia airs on Sunday, June the 3rd at 9 p.m. on BBC Two. This article was from the Herald Scotland online.
Article from the Glasgow Herald, Thursday the 7th of June. Arts. Andrew Lloyd Webber to be honoured at Classic Brit Awards. This article is unattributed. Composer Andrew Lloyd Webber will be honoured for his work and support of music education at the Classic Brit Awards. The Theatre Impresario, who supports emerging artists and music education through his Andrew Lloyd Webber Foundation, will be presented with a special recognition award for musical theatre and education at the ceremony later this month. His music will also be celebrated to mark his 70th birthday in March. Lord Lloyd Webber said, "Now that I am 70, I look back and think how lucky I have been. You are very lucky if you know what you want to do in life. I am doubly lucky that I not only have made a living out of my passion, but a hugely rewarding one. I hope through my foundation that I am able to give something back to the profession that has been so good to me. I am a passionate believer in the importance of the arts in schools, particularly music, which transcends all languages, shades of politics, race and creeds. In our increasingly dangerous and fractured world, the arts have never been as vital as they are today and should be free." Since 2010, the Andrew Lloyd Webber Foundation has awarded more than £19 million to support up-and-coming artists and the provision of music education, performing arts training and heritage skills across the UK. Lord Lloyd Webber has been vocal about cuts to music education in schools that are leaving many children without access to music lessons in the UK. Calling the cuts a national scandal, he has often highlighted the value that music education brings to the nation. Classic Brit's co-chair, Rebecca Allen, said, "Our business is built on exceptional artists. Without them, we are nothing. It is our responsibility, our duty, to seek out and support these artists, and without music being supported in schools, our bloodline stops. The work Andrew Lloyd Webber and his team do to support music in schools is significant, and we are, as an industry, must acknowledge and applaud this, for without support like this in schools, our industry will falter." The Classic Brit Awards are returning for the first time in 5 years. Other music stars taking part include Andrea Bocelli, Beatrice Rana, Sabrine Terfel, Catherine Jenkins and Tokyo Myers, who will be named Breakthrough Artist of the Year. Dame Vera Lynn has already been announced as the recipient of the Lifetime Achievement Award. The Classic Brit Awards have been hosted by musicians and Classic FM presenters Mylene Klass and Alexander Armstrong. They will take place on June the 13th at the Royal Albert Hall in partnership with Classic FM and ITV.
Remember, this programme is just a fraction of what we produce. You can access more daily content online via our website, qnreview.com/freepodcasts, for free daily podcasts of the Evening Times and Herald Scotland newspapers, weekly digests of the National newspaper, and weekly full readings of Inside Soap magazine. Now, back to the main programme.
This article from the Herald Scotland, Arts. On the 6th of June 2018, Theatre Review, Love from a Stranger, King's Edinburgh, 3 stars. This article by theatre critic Neil Cooper. Theatre, Love from a Stranger, King's Theatre Edinburgh, Neil Cooper, 3 stars. To suggest that Lucy Bailey's staging of Agatha Christie's double-bluffing yarn concerning a murderous affair between a couple on the run lulls the audience into a false sense of security is something of an understatement. In fact, things go round town and country house for so long before getting to the point, one wonders what time, what exactly it's headed for. None of this is the fault of Bailey or the cast of Frank Vosper's adaptation of Christie's short story, Philomel Cottage, updated here to the 1950s. It's just that, for all the darkroom blackout and redout on Mike Britton's modernist disreset, the script needs the sharpest of knives taken to it to give things the full oomph required. Bayswater Jill. Cecily finds herself in a whirlwind romance with American pretty boy charmer Bruce after he views the flat share she's vacating to marry Drippy Michael, who's just returned from Sudan after assorted shenanigans involving Cecily's flatmate Mavis and her annoying aunt. Michael is left in the lurch. By the second act, Cecily and Bruce are shut up in a crumpling West Sussex pile. It is here things take the infinitely darker turn, even with the light relief of an ancient gardener with his nosy granddaughter, not to mention an amateur criminologist quack. With a panoply of psychosexual sports to play, in a show led by Helen Bradbury and Sam Frensham as the dangerously impulsive new pair, there are clear shades of the League of Gentlemen at play here. However accidental, this just about gets past some of the dialogue's cottage cheese in a gloriously immoral piece of cut glass froth, so magnificently unlikely that evidence of its two-faced bit for credibility would almost certainly never stand up in court. This article by theatre critic Neil Cooper.
Celtic shareholder Trainer sells media firm in £32 million deal. An article by Scott Wright, Deputy Business Editor. Scottish entrepreneur Chris Trainer has reaped more than £30 million from the sale of his Forest Media outdoor advertising company. Mr. Trainer, who is the third biggest shareholder in Celtic Football Club with a 10.45% stake, sold the business to London-based Ocean Outdoor. The deal gave the Glasgow company an enterprise value of £32 million. Mr. Trainer was the controlling party of Forest Media through his ownership of 100% of the shares in holding company Forest Group, and the firm has no debts. Forest Media is a major player in digital out-of-home advertising in Scotland and the north of England, owning prominent sites in Glasgow, Edinburgh, Newcastle and Manchester. It reported net revenue of £8.4 million and adjusted EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation and amortisation, of £3 million for 2017, according to unaudited accounts. Ocean Outdoor said combining Forest's standing in Scotland and the north of England with its presence in London, Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, Liverpool, Bristol and Nottingham would give it a market-leading position across the UK. The deal comes at a time of continuing consolidation in the outdoor advertising market. Ocean Outdoor itself came into being following its acquisition by Oslo Partners in March, with that deal giving Ocean an enterprise value of £200 million. Shares in the merged company, which was renamed Ocean Outdoor, have since been suspended pending completion of the deal. Mr. Trainor said, when Ocean acquired Ocelot, they had an agenda which was consolidating the sector, and I think it is needed. Forest is now part of a very strong UK-wide business that is the clear market leader in that sector. Outdoor, as an industry, is competing with digital media and it has to have a strong platform. That's what this does. It's a real win-win for everybody. Forest Media will continue to be run from its Glasgow base under Managing Director Mark Keenan as part of Ocean's new Scottish division. The media business employs around 20 staff in Glasgow. Mr. Trainor, who becomes chairman of Ocean Scotland, said Forest Group will continue to own the outdoor advertising sites further to the deal, with its Forest Securities division leasing them to Ocean on a long-term basis. We're still very connected to it in that sense, Mr. Trainor said. The sale of Forest Media effectively means Mr. Trainor has more time to focus on his other business interests under the Forest Group banner. The group recently launched its first hotel, a Radisson Red, next to the SSE Hydro in Glasgow, following a £30 million investment, with Mr. Trainor having previously signalled a desire to open more hotels around Scotland and elsewhere in the UK. Other businesses in the stable include Forest Developments, which delivers commercial property projects for major retailers, and Forest Displays, focused on giant advertising banners. Forest Securities is the largest freehold landlord of outdoor advertising sites in Scotland. Mr. Trainor said, we have always been opportunity-driven and will continue to look at areas the group can evolve into out with our obvious association with Ocean moving forward. Meanwhile, Mr. Trainor said, trading at the Radisson Red has been fantastic since the 174-bedroom hotel opened its doors in April. We have been blown away by the uptake. It's been incredible, he said. Ocean said the Forest deal was funded through its cash on hand and that it would be immediately accretive to earnings. In a statement to the Stock Exchange, it said it has identified incremental synergies through combining Forest Media assets with the Ocean portfolio. Ocean reiterated that it intends to seek readmission of its ordinary shares to the stock market as soon as is practicable. Chief Executive Tim Bleakley said, Forest Media are the champions of out-of-home in Scotland, and it's a business we have long admired. This is a hugely exciting time for both companies and the sector.
This article from the Herald on Monday, the 4th of June 2018. Business. Pinsent's partner heads down under to help grow practice. This article by Margaret Taylor. The head of Pinsent Mason's Aberdeen office is relinquishing the role after just a year to take up a position in the law firm's three-year-old Australian practice. Employment partner Katie Williams, who succeeded Roger Conan as office head last May, said she is making the move to help grow the firm's offering in the Australasian region. This is an exciting opportunity to help build our business across our Perth, Melbourne and Sydney offices and the major Asia-Pacific business hubs, and I hope to support Scottish and UK businesses which have Australian interests, she said. The many lessons learned during what has been a challenging few years for all involved in the oil and gas sector will be of great benefit to clients operating in Australia's still buoyant energy sector. Ms. Williams, who joined Pinsent Masons from Aberdeen firm McKinnon's Solicitors in 2014, does work in both the offshore and marine sectors and has a particular focus on whistleblowing and discrimination claims. In light of her relocation, corporate banking specialist Richard Scott will now take charge of the firm's Aberdeen office. He joined MacGregor's, which was taken over by Pinsent Masons in 2012 as a trainee and has been based in Aberdeen for the past 8 years. He said he plans to use his term in office to maintain and build on our excellent North-East connections while supporting ambitious clients who are seeking to maximise global opportunities. Mr. Conan, who remained at the firm after stepping down as Aberdeen head, now works at its freelance lawyer arm, Vario. This article by Margaret Taylor.
If you are blind or partially sighted, or know someone who is, they may be eligible to receive a BWBF Sonata Plus internet audio player, where our podcasts are available. To qualify for a free permanent loan from BWBF of a Sonata internet radio, please contact your local agent. Please note you will need to be resident in the UK, registered blind or partially sighted, over the age of 8, and in receipt of a means-tested benefit, or have a parent or guardian in receipt if you are under 18. If you think you qualify, you can find your local agent at www.blind.org.uk. And remember, when setting up the player, ask for Q&A review. Now, back to the main programme.
Robert McNeill. The world may be in meltdown, but I'm staying cool. An article by Robert McNeill, columnist, published in the Herald Scotland of Tuesday, the 5th of June 2018. Come on, everybody. Let's cheer ourselves up with a sing-song, just like in the good old days. Pack up your troubles in your laptop bag and smile, smile, smile. Forget every problem, catch or snag, and smile, for God's sake, smile. Excuse the note of desperation in the last line there, folks. Truth is, I'm trying to keep my pecker up, and I don't mean pecker in the American sense of, you know, hell's bells, I wish I hadn't started this. It's not my fault, it's the world's. First, Visa had a network failure, causing chaos among the maddened herd. This was after earlier speculation about a Russian cyber attack. And then we were told Brexit would lead to Scotland running out of food. I don't intend dwelling on the last name scenario. My colleague upstairs is putting all that into perspective. Basically, he's on doom patrol and I'm on gloom patrol this week, telling you, after Camley's cartoon, it's a dune hill until you end up here at rock bottom. But bear in mind the old Polish saying, I reached rock bottom, then I heard knocking from underneath. So, is everybody happy? No? Excellent, then I'll begin. Visa's problem erupted across Europeshire on Friday, resulting in millions of punters being unable to use their cards. Folk couldn't pay their restaurant bills. At Markey's, they were turned away from the tills and had to put their pants back on the rack. Meanwhile, optimistic clots, hoping to avoid penury through investing cannily in a lottery ticket, found their plans had gone awry. It was a disturbing experience for many decent ratepayers and made them wonder about our modern reliance on electronic money. My wallet is nearly always empty nowadays, something the careers officer warned me about when I mentioned journalism. But the main reason is that I hardly use cash. And the trouble with that is that it makes you always traceable and so unable to escape the authorities whenever you commit a major crime. It's a serious threat to our liberties. According to Visa, the recent chaos was caused by a hardware failure. Ran out of 10p coins for the meter, and they reassured a gawping world that it wasn't the result of a cyber attack. That's the Russians' job. Yep, readers may recall that in April we were told a Russian cyber attack was imminent. Well, it's now 10 past imminent and nothing has happened, thankfully. The cyber attack would cripple our airports, rail networks, power supplies and banks and would be combined with a fake news campaign, possibly involving claims that a cyber attack was imminent. They were also supposed to release embarrassing details about the private lives of senior politicians. Boris Johnson collects twee figurines. But again, nothing was forthcoming. I sat up three nights waiting. But Seriously, a cyber attack would be bad news, especially if it affected hospitals. Cambridge University's Centre for the Study of Existential Risk. Why was I never told before that this existed? Where's its current vacancies list? Noted a security services report that said the UK was four meals from anarchy, and three of these would contain oven chips. The problem is our total reliance on electricity. Even fuel supplies, water and sewerage rely on electronic pumps. It brings to mind the prophetic words of John Lennon's classic dystopian song, "Imagine there's no lecky, it isn't hard to do, no switching on the telly, no pumping for your poo." How could the Russians be so cruel? To be fair, all this speculation followed the airstrikes on Syria when everybody expected petty Putin to put the boot in. But for all his macho vanity, he kind of came out of it all the more manly for not getting involved. Mrs. Putin, leave it, Vlad. They're not worth it. But mark this, Russia has a cyber warrior command. Worse still, like many other countries, it also has young persons, and many of these are right good at IT and happy to carry out their own rogue or madly patriotic actions. The other thing to note is that a major crippling cyber attack probably wouldn't come out of the blue, but more likely during what's known as the TTW stage, the transition to war. The key thing will be not to panic. Just sit there manfully weeping. Apart from anything else, you couldn't do the patriotic thing and get a plane out because of air traffic control would be down. Oh, don't listen to me, folks. Deafening chorus, "We weren't," followed by a voice adding, "We were just trying to see who was knocking from underneath." I'm sure the future's bright. In the meantime, I'm off to forage for edible weeds and to collect sticks to rub together for a new central heating system.
Here at Q&A Review, we're always looking for more volunteer presenters, producers and sound technicians to volunteer with us and help produce our daily talking newspapers for the blind. If you're interested, please leave a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976 or email us at information@qandreview.com. The Herald Scotland, on Friday, the 1st of June 2018. Opinion section. Kenny McCaskill, "The deification of Davidson belongs in a parallel universe." This article by Kenny McCaskill. "What are little boys made of? Snips and snails and puppy dogs' tails. What are little girls made of? Sugar, spice and everything nice." That could almost be a parody of political comment on the Tory party leadership in England compared to that of Ruth Davidson in Scotland, where one can do no right and the other can do no wrong. Davidson is venerated south of the border, even appearing now on Vogue's list of most influential women. Of course, Theresa May's Tories in the UK have become not just dysfunctional but malodorous, lurching from crisis to crisis and hanging on by a whisker in recent elections. Meanwhile, in Scotland, Ms Davidson has presided over a Tory political comeback, and to be fair, she's also been vivacious, proving popular in person and style. But in many ways, she's an extremely lucky politician in how she got there, and especially in how she's being seen. For, whatever her positioning, she is accountable for the Tories, and has proven beholden to London, whether on a Brexit that she opposed, or their social and economic policies that she decries. At the end of the day, she is as responsible as them, and has simply become the acceptable face of Toryism, but it's Toryism all the same. She is personable, as I found both in Parliament and in her previous life as a reporter, where she was firm but fair. Her sexuality and relative youth have been a breath of fresh air for a party more associated with Blue Rins ladies than young gay women. Her pregnancy, likewise, crosses a Rubicon for the party, where Jacob Rees-Mogg appears another idol and yet possesses antediluvian social views, and the party not just panders to, but is propped up by, the reactionary DUP. When she was elected leader, it was almost by accident when the leading candidate, Murdo Fraser, crashed and burned. Ironically, he did so for the heinous crime of suggesting a separate Tory party north of the border, which was loudly rejected by Ms Davidson and was evident in the support that she gained. and yet since becoming leader, her strength and prestige have been due to pursuing a distinct line, albeit not a distinct party, north of the border. By then, the Tories had also lost the toxicity that had seen them wiped out in 1997, but she benefited from their rehabilitation under the stable and debonair David McCletchie, and then the feisty and fun Great Dame in Annabel Goldie. The party wasn't back, but it was in recovery. Her early tenure saw her flung into the referendum battle, where she was again fortunate. Labour's political Harry Carey in joining the Better Together campaign saw the Tories come to the fore and her in a position to inherit, which she did in the elections following it. Both the 2016 Holyrood and 2017 Westminster elections saw the revival continue by becoming the official opposition and claiming significant SNP scalps. However, truth be told, the Tories for all that were not back at the levels they had pulled under John Major, or even in some elections under Margaret Thatcher. But perception is everything, and victory was proclaimed and perceived. She was hailed as the single-handed slayer, and a star was born for the Tory conference circuit. And again, to be fair, she's performed with aplomb. She's proven a safe pair of hands and even a star turn on occasion, such as her joust with Boris Johnson in a Brexit debate. She's portrayed as a coming force in Westminster and almost the surrogate leader of Liberal Toryism. However, there has been a distinct lack of scrutiny of the reality of her policies or positioning. The Brexit debate in which she excelled has since seen her perform not just a backflip, but a whole-scale retreat, even on issues like the customs union and the single market. The most recent distortion of the truth was in the reception given to her defence of immigration and opposition to tax cuts when the NHS faces crisis. All that was lauded by many Tory commentators south of the border, despairing of the return to the nasty party and collapse of the greatest public institution. And yet in Scotland she had decried modest tax rises to sustain public services as if the rich were being squeezed until the pips squeaked and refused to support Scottish Government proposals for a distinct immigration policy to meet the nation's evident needs. The distortion of reality continued earlier this week in an interview with the Financial Times, where she declared that if she were in Northern Ireland, she would vote to change the abortion laws. All fair and well until she added, "But as someone who operates in a devolved administration, I know how angry I would be if the House of Commons legislated on a devolved Scottish issue over the head of Holyrood." Given the ongoing debate over the powers of the Parliament, that is pretty shameless. Perhaps all this happens because the Tories are so British south of the border. But it shouldn't hide the fact that their policies are supported and replicated by their Scottish colleagues. And brutish they are, as was deftly detailed in a fine column on austerity Britain in the New York Times. There, an almost Dickensian picture was painted of civic society hurting and poverty biting. Once great institutions in North of England towns such as libraries and swimming pools were being staffed by volunteers or shutting down. Stark indeed, and not written by Robert Tressel, author of The Ragged Trousered Philanthropists, or another socialist, but by the European economic editor of one of the world's great newspapers. The response by Tory commentators was caustic indeed. Andrew Neil tweeted that it was a parody of reporting, almost as hostile to the UK now as it was slavish in its support of Stalinist Russia in the 1930s. Aye, to see ourselves as others see us, more like. This government isn't just dysfunctional, but deliberately cruel. Miss Davidson has performed well, and good luck with her pregnancy. It is a joyous moment. But politically, I can't wish her well, because she is the same old Tories, and she is equally culpable. The deification of her isn't just misplaced, but belongs in a parallel universe. This article is by Kenny McCaskill.
Herald View. New ideas provide bright future for NTS. Scotland is rightly proud of its long and vibrant history and the special places that attract visitors from all over the world. Someone has to look after this wealth of treasure, of course, and preserve it for future generations. The National Trust for Scotland, NTS, has been doing this for the last 9 decades, managing and conserving an incredible range of properties, gardens and artefacts, Munros, nature reserves and historic sites up and down the land, ensuring both locals and tourists alike can explore and enjoy them. But as leisure activities have changed, it has become harder to attract people to what some may view as rather old-fashioned days out. This, in turn, makes it harder to raise the money needed to keep the sites going, and so the decline sets in. As the NTS would admit, the last few years have been tough. Visitor numbers have declined considerably, even during a period where Scots attractions as a whole enjoyed a 45% increase. Those running the charity came up with a new investment and improvement strategy in the hope of turning things around. And if the latest figures are anything to go by, they're on the right track. Brodie Castle near Forres is a good example of how widening and modernising your offer, appealing to new audiences, can bring success. Following a substantial investment, Easter saw the opening of the new £3 million Playful Garden at the once dilapidated property, using relevant historical detail to enhance the experience for all the family. Visitors are clearly loving the new amenities, with more than 24,000 people coming through the doors of the castle since April the 30th, compared to just under 11,000 for the same period last year. New Hales, near Musselburgh, meanwhile, has also built a new play area and seen its visitor numbers soar. An improved, more contemporary retail offering is also helping boost coffers at NTS. At Culloden, for example, new products in the gift shop have increased sales by a whopping 40%. For the NTS, it's not just about visitor numbers, of course. The organisation relies on an army of workers and volunteers to show visitors round and bring the properties and sites to life, to spread the love of history and heritage, and as the workforce ages, a new generation will be needed to replace them. With Scotland's tourism industry booming like never before, the NTS has the potential to prosper, despite a period in the doldrums. It's heartening to see this old charity embrace new ideas and make the changes necessary to ensure a brighter future all round. Scotland's national heritage depends upon its success.
Herald Scotland, on Friday, the 1st of June 2018, Opinion Section. Rosemary Goring, Why I Am Raging Against the Storm of Snowflakes. This article by literary editor and columnist Rosemary Goring. The hashtag MeToo campaign has taken many scalps, deservedly so. While some have leapt upon the bandwagon to air grievances so slight or imaginary they trivialise the entire enterprise, it remains a worthy venture, whose time is long overdue. If it makes even one potential abuser think twice, it will have achieved something. And yet it's peculiar, not to mention troubling, that the latest victim of our vigorous new climate of female solidarity is neither a priapic movie mogul nor a lecherous boss, but a man who lives only between the pages of a novel. How strange a world some of us must be living in when purely imaginary individuals are viewed with the sort of disgust once reserved for those shadowy strangers lurking in the park, unbuttoning their raincoats in the dark. The latest object of naming and shaming is no threat to anyone. And yet he is to be updated, airbrushed and tamed, lest he disturb us too much. His name is Rabbit Angstrom, and he is the brilliantly complex, troubled protagonist of John Updike's five-part masterpiece, Rabbit Run, Rabbit Redux, Rabbit is Rich, Rabbit at Rest, and Rabbit Remembered. Andrew Davis, who is to TV adaptations what Michelangelo was to ceilings, has said that his forthcoming version of Updike's novels will show that the author is not a misogynist. Davis has taken on board the reservations of a script editor over Harry Rabbit Angstrom's decidedly un-PC behaviour. To put her mind at ease, he intends to give Updike's female characters greater prominence, while at the same time making Rabbit less off-putting. What next? Moby Dick without the harpoons? Flashman turned Quaker? To be fair, Davis is on Updike's side, though I'd have preferred him to abandon the project when pressured to tone the books down. That, obviously, is not an option he's prepared to consider. As he told an audience at Hay on Wye, we do want people, if not to love Rabbit, but at least to understand him. Some of the things have been a bit difficult for young, intelligent females to cope with, but I think his insight into both men and women is just so extraordinary. If Updike were still with us, he would no doubt repeat what he always said of his spectacularly flawed creation. My intention was never to make him, or any character, lovable. That people cannot read books or understand literary invention is bad enough. Even worse is that today's female viewers, old as well as young, are clearly presumed incapable of understanding why a person is portrayed the way they are. How is it that the writers on Mad Men can create monsters of misogyny without being charged with sexism, and yet Updike is assumed to be a woman-hater for depicting an intensely believable, nuanced American everyman? Why can Margaret Atwood's alias Grace be hailed as a work of genius without her being confused or conflated with her fictionalised murderer, while Updike, and indeed Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, are castigated as chauvinist for showing us the unvarnished male? Rabbit, whom we first meet in his mid-twenties when he's tired of his first wife and feeling over the hill, is the embodiment of post-war small-town America, in which the lower middle-class males struggle to make sense of everything. They felt assailed on all sides by domesticity, work, government, and God. The travails of the women who fall into Rabbit's destructive orbit are feelingly portrayed, but the focus remains on him. In Rabbit at Rest, as his demise draws close, this tormented salesman muses on the Lockerbie disaster and his own mortality. He isn't an unfeeling man. In some ways, he's oversensitive. So I'd like to know, in what way bowdlerising Rabbit and recalibrating the books helps today's women? Have we really become so squeamish or snowflake that we cannot bear to see men behaving badly, as they undoubtedly did and still do? And do we honestly think it acceptable to accuse an artist we have never even met of being a mirror image of his sometimes deplorable but mesmerising main character? Softening the books in any way is insulting and patronising. The BBC's editorial team might as well come straight out and say that they think women cannot tell fact from fiction. What a devastating indictment, especially since Me Too's credibility relies upon women hoping and needing to be believed. If we are not thought capable of making a fundamental distinction that children learn by the time they're two, why would our accusations against alleged abusers be taken seriously? Updike was no self-censorer. He revelled in being explicit and expressing unpalatable truths. To think that his magnificent, rambunctious, thought-provoking and occasionally shocking work is to be sandpapered to make it acceptable for our vanilla times is really rather pathetic. How much better if we were given a version completely true to the original? Davis should stand up to the revisionists who want to rewrite literary history and give us Rabbit Resists. After all, if we can't cope with fiction, what hope do we have with real life? This article was by literary editor and columnist Rosemary Goring. Thank you for listening to this week's edition of The Herald Scotland. This weekly talking newspaper digest was a Q&Review recording service production. The readers were volunteers at Q&Review, and the producer was Jay Kidd. Q&Review Recording Service Limited is a registered Scottish charity, number SC018016. Our registered office is at 18 Crowhill Road, Bishop Briggs, Glasgow, G641QY. Remember, you can always get in contact with us by email at information@qandreview.com or by leaving us a message on our answering service at 0141 772 3976. Remember to return your cassette in the wallet provided. Just flip over the address label and post it back to us.